Because we're not studying one of Prabhupada's books here. This standard anyway, any Vedic textbook, any traditional textbook, first of all justifies why this book, this course is being taught. We're living in Kali Yuga, and the Vedic system, ancient Vedic system, is not intact anymore. We don't have access to Vedic knowledge. Jiva Goswami discusses this in the Tattva Sandarbha. The Vedas are too extensive, they're too esoteric for almost anyone to, first of all, read through all these different books, and hardly anyone can understand the meaning. And even if you say, well, there are many great scholars, authorities, who explain these things in their commentaries, explain to us the meaning of the Vedas, the different commentators disagree with each other. There's no consensus about the purport of the Vedas. So therefore, in Kali Yuga, generally, the original Vedas are not studied. We don't have access to that ancient knowledge. Certainly, in the movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, emphasis is on Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, these two literatures. Hari Guru Vaishnav Bhagavad Gita. The whole foundation of our spiritual life is the association of the Supreme Lord in His deity form, in the form of His name, in the form of prasadam. The association of His representative, our own spiritual master, and the Vaishnav literature's Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam Gita. In the Bhagavatam itself, in the beginning, the Bhagavatam declares, Nigama Kalpa Toror Galitam Palam. Shukamokad Amitadrambha Samutam. This Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the desire tree of the Vedic literature. This is not only a very beautiful poetic image, but it's a very apt scientific description of what the Vedic literature actually is. And this is our main justification for this course, is that the Vedas, Vedic literature as a whole, all these different books, there are thousands of different books, comprise one organic whole, an organic living entity. And that's, the metaphor there is nigama kalpa turu, the desire tree of the Vedic literature. So just like a living tree has its parts, but each part is integrally, organically interconnected. The botanists can study. One scientist can specialize just on the leaves of a certain tree and ignore the roots. But he's not going to know the whole organism, just studying one part. And generally, the non-devotees, the scholars in this world, they study the Vedic literature, taking each different work in isolation. Just like dissecting a dead body or cutting off the leaves of a tree and just putting the leaves under the microscope. If we were studying this Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in some university, even if the teacher was a devotee and all the students were devotees, still, in the constricted atmosphere of the material university, we wouldn't be allowed to make our basic assumption that this Vedic literature is an organic whole, that the Bhagavatam spoken by Shukadev Goswami is part of the is a product of the same intelligence that produced the Upanishads. It's not that the Upanishads are some older, the Vedas are supposed to be the primitive according to the Western viewpoint. The original Vedas, Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, are the earliest attempts to produce a literature by very primitive people who worship the forces of nature. And then later, when they started to rise above their ignorance, they started speculating about the meaning, the higher meaning of things, and they produced the Upanishads out of their speculations. And then later on, the Brahminical religion developed, worshipping different deities, demigods, Shiva, Vishnu, and sectarian religions developed. And at that time, the Puranas, including Bhagavatam and the other Puranas, were written. So that's the Western point of view. That's the scholarly way of looking at things. From that point of view, the Vedas are an ancient literature. The Upanishads were written by other people at a different time with a different mentality. And the Puranas were written in a whole different age by a whole different set of authors. There's no unity there. So we can ignore, this purpose of our course is not to analyze and defeat that. That's not too easy. We're going to simply ignore that worldview and assume the Vedas, all of the Vedic literatures, are an organic whole, meaning that they're all part of one supremely intelligent plan of education for the conditioned souls. Okay. What are the Vedas? The word nigama in that phrase, nigama kalpa taru, literally means Vedas, as opposed to other scriptures. There's a special status that belongs to the original Vedas. They're called Shruti. Is everybody familiar with the differences between Shruti and Smriti? Could someone give me a definition of what's a Shruti and what's a Smriti? Well, first Shruti. Shrutis come first. Yes.
Whereas Smriti is commentaries on the by the Acharya on the Shruti.
Well, okay. The Shrutis are the original literatures, but there's a more specific definition of the difference. Okay.
Because by God, and the other one is about God.
Well, Bhagavad Gita is considered Smriti, and it was spoken by God. You know, it's considered in the second class, even though it was spoken by God. Anyway, it's close. The real difference, or the definition that's given in the Vedas and by various sages, is that the Shruti is eternal. It's called a Paurusheya. It doesn't have any author. You can say spoken by God. And that's true. It's described in the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. Ato mahadbhutasya nikshvashatam idam yad rig vedo yajur veda, etc. The Vedas and all the other Vedic literatures are the breath of the Supreme Person. So yes, they were spoken by God. They emanate from Him. But nobody wrote the Vedas. Not even God. Just like God didn't create the Jivas the way you read in Greek mythology or even in the Bible. You know, the Prometheus, made image of man out of a lump of mud, and then he breathed air into that lump of mud. And a similar story is there in the Bible, that man was created out of nothing. The spirit soul was created by God out of nothing. The soul wasn't created. The soul is eternal, co-eternal with God. And so are the Vedas. So nobody wrote the Vedas, not even Krishna. They exist eternally with Him. They emanate from Him. There's no time when He sat down and decided to write the Vedas. That's Shruti, eternal literature. And Shruti, the name Shruti is describing how that literature is specially dealt with. The Shruti has to be heard. It's only been written down in Kali Yuga. Traditionally, Shruti has to be learned and passed on from generation to generation by careful hearing and repeating. And it's important that not one syllable or one intonation, every word in the original Vedas, each word has a special accent or intonation. Not one syllable can be changed, not one accent can be altered. It's fixed, eternal. That's Shruti literature. That's the original literature. It has special status. It's the original authority is the Vedas. All knowledge is based on the Vedas. And Smriti is secondary literature. Great sages, through their realization, on the basis of their realization, compose their own books. And those are called Smritis. They're created by some Living entities, intelligence. That's smriti. And smriti means remembered. Based on a sage's own realization, what he realizes, what he remembers, he writes his own book. That's called smriti. So the original shrutis have a special authority. Even though the Vaishnavas are much more interested in studying Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita than any other books. Because there, Krishna consciousness, the glories of Krishna and his devotees, is fully realized in the Bhagavatam and in Krishna's own words in the Bhagavad Gita. Not even in the other Puranas is Krishna consciousness fully revealed like that. And in the Vedas, the absolute truth, the personality of the absolute truth is not fully realized, fully revealed. It's the absolute truth is presented more or less impersonally, more or less indirectly in the other Vedic literatures, even in the original Vedas. So therefore, Vaishnavas are mostly interested, mostly attracted to the Bhagavatam and the Gita. But for the purpose of establishing what is the absolute truth, for scientific knowledge, tattva jnana, the authority of the Vedas is absolute and basic. Even Krishna himself, when he's talking to Arjuna in the Gita, when he gets to the 13th chapter, 13th chapter, and last six chapters of the Gita deal with Jnana Yoga, where more philosophical topics are discussed. At that point, Krishna introduces, at the beginning of the 13th chapter, Krishna states to Arjuna that I'm not simply speaking my own opinions, my own realizations. Krishna says, Rishibhya Bahudha Gitam Chandobig Vividaik Pritak Pritak Brahmasutra Padais Chaiva Hetu Madbhya Vinishchitai. Arjuna, yes, you can accept what I say because I'm your friend and I happen to be the absolute Supreme Personality of Godhead. But I'm not only speaking on my own authority, I'm basing everything I'm saying, at least from this point on, now that we're discussing technical philosophical matters, I'm going to base everything I say on what has been stated previously by the great sages on the pages of the Vedas. Rishibhir Bahudha Gitam, in various ways, Chandobi, in the original Vedic mantras. So Krishna says the sages are speaking the Vedas. Maybe that seems to contradict the claim that the Vedas don't have any author. Only apparently. The Vedic rishis are not supposed to be understood as authors. They didn't write these books. They are the seers. In their meditation, they receive the eternal Vedic mantras that have been forgotten in human society, and they pass them on through their disciples in succession. They pass them on to human society. So they're the transmitters, like a television transponder. You have a microwave tower on a hill. You can even see here in Mathura Mandala, sometimes these microwave towers. The television program is originating in Delhi. It's being passed on every 10 kilometers or so from one tower to the other. And they're called transponders. They receive the program and just reflect it. So a Vedic rishi is like that. He receives the eternal mantras and just reflects it or repeats it. So that's the Shruti, eternal literature. Nobody ever wrote them. They're called the Paurusheya. And therefore they have absolute authority. And the authority of the Smriti, including the Puranas, bases itself. Even Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself, bases his authority by alluding to and sometimes directly quoting from Upanishads. There are verses in the Bhagavad Gita, we'll see, that are exact reflections of a few verses here in this Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Okay, now in the Shruti, in the original Vedas, there are different divisions. The Vedas are a desire tree. A desire tree means that anybody can pick whatever fruit he wants off that tree. So the Vedas serve various purposes for people who have different kinds of desires. In this world, there are karmis, there are jnanis, They're yogis and they're devotees, basically. Most people are karmis, meaning that they want to work so they can get some material success. Therefore, the Vedas, the original Vedas, seem, 90% of the Vedic texts seem to belong to the karmakanda category. They serve the purpose of educating human beings how to act as civilized persons. The Vedic system of sacrifice is taught in the karmakanda portion of the Vedas to make people civilized. Oh, yeah, roughly 90%. That's what I didn't make an analysis myself, but I read that. Yes, most of the Vedas. If you pick up a copy of the Rig Veda, or any of the four Vedas, or the original books that are also part of the Vedas called Brahmanas, that explain the purpose of the mantras, it's all pertaining to how to perform sacrifice in order to sanctify your material activities, to raise your consciousness to a higher level by dedicating the work you're going to do anyway to a higher purpose. I want to get a son. I want to be successful in business. I want to go to heaven. There are particular Vedic sacrifices you can perform to fulfill those desires. By performing the sacrifice, the material work becomes purified and the performer of the sacrifice becomes elevated in spiritual understanding gradually. So the original mantras are there in the four Vedas. We don't have time to describe in detail the kinds of mantras that you find in the Vedas. That's a whole different subject. But the original mantras are mostly addressed, they're used for chanting in sacrifice, they're addressed to the demigods. To the demigods who are part and parcels of the Supreme Person. They're glorifying the demigods, describing their great qualities, and making various requests to the demigods for material benefits. So the original mantras of the Vedas, of the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, are not really meant for human understanding. They're addressed to higher intelligence, to the demigods. So we don't get philosophical understanding. Human intelligence cannot really decipher the purpose of the original Vedic mantras. There's another, there's a second division of the Vedas called the Brahmanas that start giving interpretation, give explanation of the mantras. But it's all ritualistic interpretation. How the Vedic mantras can be used to perform a sacrifice and why. You know, what is the origin of the mantras and why they have ritual significance. But it's all on the ritual level. How to use the mantras to perform a sacrifice to get some material benefit. That's called the Brahmanas. Very extensive literature. That's considered an integral part of the original Vedas. You have the mantras and then the Brahmanas. The Brahmanas are the explanations, but the ritualistic explanations. That's the Karmakanda. The second basic division of the Vedas, which forms a small portion, is called, you know, physically it's 10% or less of what is considered the Vedas, is what's called the Gyanakanda, where philosophical instruction is given. This part of the Vedas is meant for human understanding. It's meant to educate human beings who want to understand philosophically, who aren't satisfied to just perform some rituals to get some limited benefit. How does this go? Pariksha lokan karma chittan nirvedam ayat nastya kritak kritena. This is from the Katha Upanishad. It says, after seeing with your own eyes the limitations of what can be achieved by performing ritual sacrifice, a person who is introspective and intelligent, after performing so many sacrifices, he sees, well, yes, I can go to heaven, I can get different kinds of benefits, but these results of performing sacrifice are all limited and temporary. Nastya kritak kritena. By performing some material work, The Vedic sacrifice is also material in that sense, that it only brings material benefits. You can't attain what is eternal. Or it says literally, nasti akrita kritena. The spiritual world is not something created. Whereas everything you do in this world is a material creation. My own work is a material act. I can't achieve by material creation what is not created, what is eternal. So an intelligent person becomes disinterested in the karmakanda and wants to understand better the higher purpose of life. For that minority of people, even among those who follow the Vedic path, the jnanakanda is presented. This is called Veda Shiraha, the culmination, the head of the Veda, just like the body has a head, the most important part of the body, the most highly developed part of the body, the brain, and the important senses are situated in the head. So the head of the Vedas, the culmination of the Vedas, this is the Upanishads, the Jnanakanda. We can accept that the Upanishads are also Vedas. They're an integral part of the Vedas. They're not some later composition by different authors, by somebody who came later on, speculators. They're eternal just like the rest of the Vedas, but they're in a different kind of language because they serve a special purpose. They're also called Vedanta. Vedanta means the end, the culmination of the Vedas. So the word Vedanta originally means Upanishads. In the Upanishads, which were received by various sages, and in the Upanishads we hear different persons of sages and others speaking, but we understand that these texts are actually eternal. In these Upanishads, we're given, in various ways, instruction how to understand the Absolute Truth and how to understand our own identity, spiritual identity, and our spiritual relationship with the Absolute Truth. And various methods of realizing the Absolute Truth are taught in the Upanishads, especially the method called Upasana. So Upasana is very often translated as worship, but it's not the same as performing a Vedic fire sacrifice. It's not ritual worship. It's not puja, it's not deity worship in the sense that we perform in the modern age. It's meditation. In Satyayuga, this was the form of worship, meditation. So Upasana means worshiping or practicing to realize and worship the Absolute Truth in your mind by systematic meditation. And the Upanishads, in various places, give detailed instructions how to meditate. They describe various ways to think about the Absolute Truth as a form of developing God consciousness. We'll see this in the Svetashra of Taru Upanishad. There's a lot of the purpose of this Upanishad is to teach this method of Upasana, how to meditate on the Absolute Truth. So we have to understand the basic style of this. We're going to look at this text. I think everybody has a copy of it. Or does anybody not have a copy yet? Okay. You have signed up for the course? If you enrolled for the course, they would have given you a copy. If you haven't, you can go maybe after the class. If not, after the class, if not, the office is not open tomorrow morning, and they'll give you a copy of the book. When you start looking at this book, you'll see that it's written in a strange style. It's not a linear logical presentation. You may look at it and say, well, what is it trying to say? What is the point? What is it trying to prove? It seems to be very repetitive. But we have to understand, this is not a linear logical presentation is trying to prove something, like a textbook on geometry, to prove the point that every triangle has 180 degrees, and then build various theorems on top of that. The purpose of this text and the other Upanishads is to teach us how to realize the absolute truth and our relationship with the absolute truth. And that's not a matter of proving that 1 plus 2 equals 3. Just like in Prabhupada's preaching and in the preaching of all Vaishnavacharyas, those who are serious about educating their disciples are concerned that the disciples understand the basic points of spiritual life. There's no need to go into the details of Krishna's intimate pastimes until we understand we're not this body. So if you listen to any lecture by Srila Prabhupada, you'll hear about how you're not this body over and over again. And you won't hear very much in Prabhupada's lectures about Krishna's Rasa-lila and other intimate matters. Because first we have to understand the basic points. And we have to hear things over and over again in our conditioned state. So therefore the style of this Upanishad especially is very repetitive. And it's intentionally so. And the way I want to approach this book is rather than ignoring that fact, thinking, well, this is, you know, it's just not poetry. And therefore we have to tolerate this flaw. We'll consider it not as a flaw, but actually is a very intentional part of the design of this literature. The repetition is purposeful. And I want to study the poetic style of this Upanishad, looking carefully at how it is repetitive and studying the repetitions and seeing the purpose of it. We can understand it helps us pick out the basic themes of the Upanishad to look at phrases and words that are repeated over and over again. So the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is not one of the first Upanishads that are usually studied. There are 10 most significant Upanishads from the point of view of Vedanta Sutra. In the Vedanta Sutra, Vyasadeva wrote his own commentary on the Upanishads. Vedanta means Upanishads. So Vedanta Sutra means commentary on the Upanishads. And there, Vyasadeva shows that the Upanishads, although they seem to be describing different things and seem to sometimes contradict each other, are actually very consistent. They're all very consistently describing the nature of the absolute truth. Ultimately, they're describing devotional service, the Upanishads. So Vyasadeva, in the Vedanta Sutra, scientifically, philosophically, it proves this. And he, although there are 108 or even more Upanishads, in the Vedanta Sutra, Vyasadeva specifically or most commonly refers to about 10 or 15 different Upanishads. These are called the Vedanta Upanishads, the ones that are very often referred to in the Vedanta Sutra. So this is among the 11, Shvetashvatara Upanishad is counted. It's referred to when we look at the Vaishnav or even Shankaracharya's commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, we see that according to the commentator, the Vedanta Sutra is alluding to statements in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad quite often. Not all the Acharyas who wrote on Vedanta wrote commentaries on this Upanishad. Madhvacharya didn't write one. He wrote on 10 Upanishads only, and this one he didn't write a commentary on. But before him, Shankaracharya, he may have written a commentary. There's a book published that's supposed to be Shankaracharya's commentary on the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. But some people disagree that it's bogus. It's not really written by Shankaracharya. In any case, we know that Shankaracharya quotes the Shvetashvatara Upanishad in his Vedanta commentary at least 50 times, even if he never wrote a separate commentary. So in any case, among all the Acharyas, the Mayavadis and the Vaishnavs, this is a very important work from the philosophical point of view of Vedanta. Each Upanishad has its different mood and it's written for a special audience. So like the Mundaka Upanishad begins more from a ritualistic point of view. It's written for Brahmins who are attached to Vedic rituals. And it explains to them that you can go ahead and be a ritualistic Brahmin, but you should try to realize the higher purpose of life through your worship. Don't be attached just to the rituals, or else you won't make any spiritual development. That's the basic message of the Mundaka Upanishad. It's written for that audience. Shvetashvatara Upanishad, however, is written for a different audience. It was spoken, according, we can read in the text itself, it was spoken by one sage called Shvetashvatara. It's named after him. And this was at a meeting or an assembly of very renounced sannyasis. The word is adyashramis, those who belong to the last ashram. And they were sitting together and wondering, what is the cause of existence? Especially, why do we have to suffer in life? Why are we in ignorance? So it's an inquiry about Brahman that begins the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And among them, one of the sages, who is especially self-realized, speaks to the other sages his realization. And that's the text of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. But we can understand it was spoken to an audience of renounced sages, not householders, not ritualists. So it doesn't have to discuss why we should give up materialism, why you're not this body. The audience already understands this. It talks on a very more elevated level about what is the nature of the Absolute Truth, how we can understand that Absolute Truth, how we can realize our relationship with the Absolute Truth, and ultimately how the Absolute Truth is a person, and how the Jiva soul, the Supreme Soul, and material nature are separate entities. We have to understand the difference between God and his energies. This is all taught in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. But because it's spoken to a very austere audience of renounced sannyasis, it's written in a very austere style. It may not appeal to everyone as elegant reading, as being very poetical. But it has, in its own way, its own kind of poetry. To me, it seems like, I get the impression that it's like some very austere, very angular sculpture. It's like, if you're familiar with the sculpture of the French artist Rodin, he made this because it's a very famous sculpture of the thinker. It's very angular, very sharp, austere. So just like a sculpture also, the way you view a sculpture, it doesn't progress linearly. It doesn't move from one point to the other. It stays in one place, but it has different sides. You walk around the sculpture and you look at it from different angles. Same thing. Like that, the style of this work is so repetitive that it almost seems like there are 113 verses, but it's almost as if there's only one verse repeated with variations, and you're looking at the same verse from different angles. We'll see that when we start reading it. So that's also something like Indian music. Some people don't like Indian music because it seems very repetitive. There's a short motif of a few bars, repeated, sometimes hundreds of times, with minor variations. So the educated, the audience who has a taste for this music, they can sit through 3 hours of a recital of such music, classical Indian music, and they're entranced listening to all the minor variations and how things are repeated over and over again. It's a matter of taste. So my invitation is that we try to develop a taste for the style of this work. And for that purpose, I've done an analysis of the repetitions. You'll see in your course material. The method of the course is, I realized over the course of the 2 months that I spent putting this together that there's more material here that we can discuss. We have about 10 minutes for each verse. There's 113 verses. So we can't just even speak about everything that's in this booklet. So you're responsible to read ahead, read the translations, and you'll see that with each verse, I give the translation and a number of verses that are quoted from the Bhagavatam, from the Gita, from different Puranas that are related, that speak the same ideas, and sometimes are directly reflecting the text. So, read ahead. We're going to cover from 5 to 8 verses every day. You're responsible to have read all this material beforehand. And could everybody open the book and take a look at any of the verses here? You'll see under the transliteration, before the word-for-word synonyms, on the right side, in parentheses, there's a list of numbers. Okay, those numbers are a key to this second booklet. Everyone has this? The one that's just stapled together. About 25 pages. Okay, now in here, we have a list of the repetitions, or what I say, the echoes, of phrases and sometimes whole lines that are repeated in the Upanishad itself. So, what you should try to do when you're reading each text is look up each one of these references. Just like for verse 1.1, the very first verse, it says number 40. So if you look up 40 in this little booklet, you turn to page 146, you'll see that here the word Brahma is highlighted, and it shows the whole list of all the different verses in the Upanishad where the same word is repeated. And the verse numbers are given at the end of each line. It may be tedious, you may find it tedious, but try it. You know, you can get a sense of the style of the work, and we'll discuss these repetitions and these echoes in the class the next day. But we won't have time to read through them all. So you're responsible to look up each of these and sort of try to meditate on them. If you don't find it too much, you could take each one of the lines that you see in this list and go to the verses that they're in and look at the translation. Then you can understand the meaning, if you can find time for that. That in itself is a meditation on the Upanishad, and that's the purpose of the Upanishad, to teach us how to meditate. Okay. We have a few minutes. I wanted to show one example of the kind of repetitious style the Upanishad has. Maybe we can have a little realization of the purpose of it. If we look in this smaller booklet, the one that's just stapled, under number 1, the very first page. Here, there's a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sections here, separated. And I've shown how the same lines and phrases are repeated, sometimes in a very complex way, among verses. This is something of an extreme example, but it shows how complexly the Upanishad is reflecting itself or echoing itself repeatedly. Just like here, if you look in the first verse that's quoted here, Tatak Param Brahma Param Brihantam. Everyone sees that? Then the second line, I put in parentheses here, this phrase, Sarva Bhuteshu Gudham, which means hidden inside every living entity, in the heart of every living entity. So that phrase is repeated again. If you jump down 1, 2, 3 verses to the verse 416 that begins Gritat Param, in the second line again, in the same place, that same phrase is repeated. And so I to indicate that, I put the phrase in parentheses, and I put a little superscript 1 to identify the phrase. And then 3 verses down, where it shows up again in the second line, you see it again in parentheses with the number 1. So if you look again in that first verse, look in the third line. The whole third line gets repeated several times, or 3 times, I think. So I numbered that 2 with the superscript 2. Vishwasyaikam pariveshtataram, which means, these are all descriptions of Brahman. The Supreme Person is the one, eka means one, the one who envelops, who surrounds the whole universe. Vishwasyaikam pariveshtataram. So that's all in parentheses, the whole line, number 2. The verse just be 2 verses below that. The verse begins sukshmati sukshmam. The second line is the same. The third line. Vishwasyaikam pariveshtataram. Again, the whole line gets repeated. That's verse 4:14. Then 2 verses later, you go down to 4:16, the next verse listed here. Again, the third line is the same. Vishwasyaikam pariveshtataram. And then the next chapter, chapter 5, verse 13, again, Vishwasyaikam pariveshtataram shows up again. It goes on like that. This word in the fourth line of the first verse listed, the word gyatva, meaning knowing, realizing. The line says, Isham tam gyatva amrita bhavanti. By knowing that Supreme Lord, persons become immortal. They attain liberation. This is, practically speaking, the basic theme of the whole Upanishad, the basic message. By knowing the Supreme, you become immortal, you attain liberation. And that's repeated over and over again, sometimes worded different ways. That formula is given in various, in several different variations. So the word gyatva is very, very often repeated, because it's part of that basic theme. It's there. I numbered it 3. You see the fourth line, gyatvas, in parentheses is a little 3 after it. In the verse 2 verses further down, it says sukshmati sukshma. Again, that same gyatva shows up in the fourth line, and the second and fourth line of the verse after that, in the fourth line of the verse after that. And that whole line, gyatva devam muchate sarva pashai, that whole line shows up in 5 different verses. In every chapter except for the third chapter, that line shows up. Anyway, that's just a sample of how the style of the work, how it repeats itself. And by doing that, it emphasizes various ideas and directs us to meditation. You know, even though the logic is going not in a straight line but around in circles, dancing around in a circle. But that's the intentional style of the work. Okay. So that this notation I used here with parentheses and superscripts, that's only in this first example. This is just one extreme example of how complex it gets. The other examples here, I just highlight the word that's or phrase that's repeated. And I picked out 193 different cases of words and phrases that are repeated sometimes many times. Okay. So, are there some questions or comments? Yes.
What do you see in addition 1.8b and...
Okay. Oh, that's... Yeah, when I give the verse number 1.8 and then I say D, that means that's the line number. Line A, line B. The first line, second line, third line, fourth line is A, B, C, D. Okay. Anyway, if this scares you, you have 3 days to quit the course. You can make it be right. Yeah. Yeah.
When you were going through the different parts of the Vedas, the Karmakanda.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I went real fast. Yeah.
I thought I also said, because you were in the Jnana Kanda.
Yes.
And then you started talking about Vedanta and Upanishads.
Okay. The Upanishads are the basic texts of the Gyanakanda. That's what the Gyanakanda consists of. The Upanishads are where you get philosophical instruction. They are the Gyanakanda. And the Vedanta, they're called Vedanta. And the Vedanta Sutra is Vyasadeva's commentary on the Upanishads. Yes,
ma'am. Upasana.
Yes. We can understand that actually Upasana Kanda is a subsection. It's a part of the Gyanakanda. Because Gyanakanda, we can understand Brahman, the absolute truth, theoretically, you know, as a matter of theory, you know, scientific description of what is Brahman. But then we can also get instruction on how to meditate on Brahman, how to direct our own consciousness. That's Upasana. Because that turns into devotional service. It's one style. There are different methods of devotional service. Kriteya Jayato Vishnum, in Satya Yuga especially, this was the standard method of devotional service, to sit down and meditate. And the Upanishads taught that meditation. In Treta Yuga then, the system of ritual sacrifice was taught for the purpose of developing Krishna consciousness. It was the method of becoming Krishna conscious in Treta Yuga. And deity worship in the Dwarpa Yuga and in Kali Yuga Sankirtana. Very much. We'll see, studying this book. The Sretashvatara Upanishad is more openly personal than some of the other Upanishads. The Supreme is called Deva over and over again in this Upanishad. Although, because the audience is not, they're not devotees, they're sannyasis, but not pure devotees. So therefore, the personality of God is not named. His personality is not specified in this Upanishad. He's given the name Rudra, but then he's described in ways that obviously are a description of Lord Vishnu. So it's still a more or less indirect approach to the personality of Godhead, but it's more personal than some of the other Upanishadic presentations. In that sense, it's not only upasana in the sense of meditation, impersonally, but it's also very devotional. In the last verse of this Upanishad says, Yasya deve para bhaktir, yata deve tata gurau. Someone who has bhakti, the word bhakti is given. Para bhakti, implicit, unconditional devotion for the Supreme Person, Deva. Yata deve tata gurau, and who has equal devotion, Sante Mahatmana. To that, such a great rare soul, the purports of this literature is revealed. So the emphasis on bhakti is there. But you won't find Krishna. If you want to see Krishna's name, you won't find it here. You'll see the name Rudra. Once the name Mahaprabhu is given, indirect allusion. But if what you want to hear is Krishna Leela, then sign up for a different course. This is... unfortunately, not the Bhagavatam. This is indirect presentation of the Absolute Truth, more or less. But we'll try to present it so that we get an appreciation how the Vedic literature is a whole. Then we can appreciate better, hopefully, the cream, the ripened fruit of the Vedic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, by understanding what the whole tree is like. And the Shvetashvara Upanishad has it's in a good position because it's somewhere in the middle of the tree. Although all the Vedas, including the Upanishads, are eternal, there is a sort of apparent history. You know, there are the original Vedas, and then there are different Upanishads. And among the Upanishads, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is approaching the devotional position more than some of the other Upanishads. So it's sort of in the middle of the tree. And from that middle position, it's just like if you stand in the middle of a room, in the middle of the temple room, you can hear a lot of echoes. So in the middle, echoes are reinforced from both ends, the front and the back. So there, we'll see in this work a lot of echoes from the original Rig Veda and Yajurveda. There are direct quotations from both of them in this Shvetashvatara Upanishad. And then on the other side, there are many echoes from this work that you find in the Puranas and Bhagavad Gita. There are at least two verses in the Bhagavad Gita that are direct quotes from this, from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. because I say quotes, but we understand all the Vedic literatures are eternal. Even the Bhagavad Gita is eternal. Krishna says that. So the what quotes what? Does the root echo the is the root imitating the leaf, or the leaf imitating the root? If it's all one organic whole and it all existed eternally, then it's not really a question of which part of the tree is plagiarizing the other or copying from the other. It's just reflecting back and forth. So the higher purpose we can serve by this course is to get some appreciation of actually how the Vedic literature is an organic whole. And we can see some of the roots of the literature that we're mostly interested in, Gita and Bhagavatam. We can delve a little bit into the roots of that literature. Okay, any other comments? Okay, we can stop here. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.